Welcome to Just Curious Media. This is That's a Crime. I'm Jason Connell.
And I'm Sal Rodriguez.
Well, Sal, here we are back for episode 2. And today we are covering the Baylor Bears basketball murder from 2003.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting case because I personally am not a follower of NCAA sports.
Yeah.
So this is sort of me peering into a world which I'm sort of unfamiliar with.
It's true. And after covering D.B. Cooper, our initial episode of That's a Crime, that dates back to 1971, but a crime that I knew about forever and wanted to launch this new show with, this particular episode I do remember. But the fact that it deals with Baylor and their college program, and having gone to Oklahoma State, which is also in the Big 12 Conference and a rival of Baylor, I remember this case, Sal. And not only do I remember it from the basketball program in Baylor, but the fact that we just finished March Madness and Baylor Bears won the title just kind of put this back on my radar. And I felt like it was timely. We needed to cover it now. And I'm surprised more people weren't talking about this while Baylor won on their triumphant run recently.
Well, that would have been a downer, you know. It's like everybody's all excited celebrating that people are like, hey, you guys, put down that trophy for a second. Remember the murder? Like that would have been a buzzkill.
I thought there would be some mention in some sort of memorial way or, hey, we did this for, it just hadn't come up. And you know, it's been a long time. This is 2003. We're in 2021. So I get it, but it resonated with me because I'm not a Baylor fan, but I'm close enough to the conference. But that's what made me want to make it episode 2, because it made me want to go back and read about it and learn more about this case that I was definitely familiar with when it happened.
Yes. Well, let me ask you, Jason, because, you know, I assume everybody who's over 6 foot plays basketball. Do you have any background in basketball?
I do, man. I used to be a gym rat.
Yeah.
Yes. I was addicted to basketball, loved it. Now, I'm not 6'6", 6'7", 6'10". I'm 6'2" and a half.
Yeah.
But
to me, you might as well be 6'7".
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. I'll play basketball sometimes. It's like, you're the center. I'm like, I'm the center? No. And like pro ball, I'm a guard.
Yes,
but
yes.
No, I'm more of a power forward. And no, I loved playing. I was totally addicted. I played a lot, you know, in my youth. I played for schools. I played in leagues. And more recently, I played in Los Angeles at my old club, the LA Athletic Club, and the gymnasium there, the John Wooden basketball court. We would just have open basketball nights, open gym, and we would run for hours, Sal. So yeah, I love it. But as I segued more into soccer and martial arts, I have not played as much basketball in recent years.
I'm proud to say that I was very good at horse and around the world.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, never actual games, but horse and around the world. As a matter of fact, I even won a elementary school championship in around the world.
Very well done.
Around the world is your game when you're 5'8".
There you go. You shoot granny style.
Hey, if that's what the person before me did in horse, if the guy before you in
calls
horse
it.
Shoots,
yeah,
you got to do whatever they do.
Well, back to this. This case deals with the unfortunate murder of Patrick Dennehy, who was a basketball player for Baylor.
Yeah.
And the murder occurred on June 12, 2003. And Sal, one of the worst parts about it is that he was shot by a teammate of his on the Baylor Bears basketball team.
Not just a teammate, but apparently his best friend and roommate. So
true.
It goes even further than that.
Yes. And this led to the demise of Baylor basketball and the scandal, the cover-up, and everything else. Yeah, it's quite a story. And again, triumphant now, but at this point in time in the basketball program, in the athletic program, it was about as low as it can be.
So wait, when was the last championship you said?
They'd never won one in basketball.
Never?
In men's basketball.
Oh, okay. Never before. Okay, so this was the first. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm ready to jump in whenever you are.
Yeah, I'm all set because I have a lot of questions.
So Patrick James Dennehy was born January 28th, 1982, and was born in Santa Clara, California, just up the way near SF, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, definitely. I have relatives in San Jose, relatives in Sunnyvale. That is all, I believe, part of Santa Clara County.
Patrick was 6'10", so a great height for a basketball player, and he transferred to Baylor from the University of New Mexico following his sophomore year in 2001-2002. So, Sal, this happens a lot in athletics. Maybe you're familiar, maybe not, but a lot of college transfers, especially in basketball and football, but they'll go somewhere, maybe they put some weight on or have some production, and all of a sudden the bigger universities are more attracted to him than maybe they were coming out of high school. Yeah. So not uncommon at all. And Baylor is a much bigger university, not to put University of New Mexico down, but Baylor's in the Big 12, a power conference. So he transferred over and he redshirted that first season. So are you familiar with that term?
I actually had to Google that, Jason. Can you explain a little more what redshirting means?
So redshirting means you're just not going to play that year. You don't lose any eligibility, but you're on the program. You can practice with the team. You're part of the team. You're just not going to play because you only have so much eligibility in college athletics.
Only 4 years, I understand.
Right. And he already had played at University of New Mexico. So you redshirt him a year, get him into your program. Then he has whatever eligibility he has left, but you don't waste years. Happens in football a lot. You bring in like a redshirt freshman. And sometimes if there's injuries, you can take their redshirt off and you can play them. And then that year would just count against their time.
So the whole point is to kind of give them an extra year, sort of.
Well, sort of. It allows you to coach them up, I guess. Sometimes you want guys to bulk up or see how things work there. They're working on stuff in practice. There's a million different reasons. If someone's ready to go, though, and you have a need, you don't have to redshirt them. It's really at the discretion of the coach.
Sure. Otherwise, you're expecting everybody to go 0-60 all of a sudden.
Exactly. Dennehy was prepping to play for the Baylor Bears in the upcoming 2003 and 2004 season. Carlton Dodson was a junior power forward on the team and also a friend of Dennehy's who had transferred to Baylor in the summer of 2002. So Sal, he actually played for Baylor for 1 year already.
But was there a time when Dodson and Dennehy actually played together?
So no, unfortunately, Dennehy never even got to play an actual game for Baylor. Oh, he was there getting ready, part of the program, but never played, where his friend Carlton had already played 1 year for them.
Mm-hmm, I see. Yeah.
And so in the summer of 2003, reports surfaced that Dennehy and Dodson, very good friends, were concerned about their safety. Now, Sal, this is where this story gets a little bit wonky for me. There's like, what's going on here?
Yeah, because you know what? There's no other information. I mean, what does that even mean?
Nothing.
Concern for their safety. The rest is just speculation as far as what that means.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a different time. We don't have the level of social media or camera phones or video phones yet. So, you know, there's a lot missing. There's a big hole. These are two friends. All of a sudden, they're concerned about their safety. Did they get into an argument with someone else? Who knows what was at play? But it led them to go and purchase pistols and a rifle. And they started practicing on targets at some farm north of Waco.
So now when I hear Waco, of course, I think of David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, which I think happened sometime in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good 10 years before this.
Yeah. So unfortunately, more blood on the flag of Waco, unfortunately.
Yes, indeed. And so during this time, Dennehy's friend, Daniel Okopny, said he spoke on the phone with Dennehy on June 14th. And Dennehy said that he was worried about threats made to Dodson by two teammates. So Sal, now we're bringing more teammates into the fold.
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented. We don't have either in pro sports or college sports, teammates threatening the lives of other teammates. This isn't something that happens.
Very rare indeed, Sal. Some of this does not add up. And then Dennehy also indicated that he and Dodson would be at a party the following day at which neither appeared. Now, let's go back to that date that Okopny mentioned. That's June 14th. Unfortunately, Patrick was killed on June 12th, 2003. So we've already got some sort of cover-up job happening here.
Wait, so Dennehy died on the 12th, and yet Okopny says he spoke with him on the 14th.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, this sort of, at this point in time, loosely reminds me of the Aaron Hernandez case, where he and others took another party out, killed them, and then did these really bad cover-up jobs. And so very similar, although in this instance, we're talking about teammates and friends and saying other teammates are threatening us. So things, again, are not adding up. So over the next few days, there were indications that something had gone wrong. And Dennehy's mother and stepfather Valerie and Brian Brabazon were concerned that they had not received calls on Father's Day, and Dennehy's roommate, Chris Turk, returned from an out-of-town trip to find that Dennehy's dogs had not been fed in days.
You know, as a pet owner, as a person who has had animals his whole life, sometimes before I leave the house, I will give a little extra food just in case I don't come back. It's a horrible thought, but I do think of, what if I don't return? At least my animal has a few more days of food.
That's really kind of you. And I think about these things all the time. Like, just in this instance, my heart goes out to, of course, the Dennehys and the family, but also the dogs. So I totally get it. But now things are starting to go off, Sal. This chain of events here, no call on Father's Day. I'm assuming he had a great relationship with his parents. And obviously, he cares for his dogs. There's some signs.
Yeah. Well, you know what's good is when you know people and you know their habits. If your son doesn't call you on Father's Day, you know there's a problem,
right?
You know something's wrong. The red flags go off. And so I think that's why it's really good when you have family and friends who see, hey, something's not right here.
Exactly. So then on June 19th, the Brabazons filed a report with the Waco Police Department that Dennehy was missing. And then on June 25th, Dennehy's Chevrolet Tahoe was found in the parking lot of a mall in Virginia Beach, Virginia, with its license plates removed. Yeah. Not good, Sal.
Well, yeah. It's also getting very sloppy. You know, it's...
Yeah.
For a first kill, this killer is sloppy.
This is often the cover-up job of something that escalated to murder, and then this is either a group of people or a person who are way out of their element, Sal.
Well, it brings up the idea of premeditated murder or not premeditated, right? It's almost like this is sloppy enough where you think this was not necessarily premeditated.
Yeah. So then an informant in Delaware told police that Dotson, who was home now in Maryland, confided in a cousin that he had shot and killed Dennehy during an argument while firing guns in the Waco area.
Oh, no, no. See, this is where it all starts to go downhill for this guy. Well, okay, I'm not going to say like if he is the killer. He is the killer. He's been convicted.
Yes.
But see, that's what I mean why I don't think this was premeditated, because this whole thing is just very sloppy after Dennehy's death.
Absolutely. There was a cover-up. Dennehy's car was moved states away without plates. And now you're confiding in someone about what you did. Yes, Sal. Bad moves. You'd almost be better off going out and saying, hey, this happened, and during the midst of this, we had a fight. But yeah, all signs are starting to point to Dotson at this point in time. And on July 21st, Dotson was charged with Dennehy's murder and taken into custody in Maryland.
Yeah, I mean, so sloppy, I'm thinking that if he did kill his friend in the heat of the moment, some sort of moment of extreme anger or passion, he kills his friend and roommate, you call the police immediately.
Exactly.
Running? What do you think? You're going to get away? I mean, come on. So yeah, very, very sloppy. He played his cards all wrong. That's what leads me to believe that this was not premeditated, because how could it be this sloppy if it was?
And what about Daniel Copney, Sal, with his, oh, I talked to Dennehy just the other day, 2 days after he had already been killed. It's like, what's his role? Is he an accomplice in this? There's no more mention of him.
Yeah, and no charges have been brought on him to my knowledge. So he was somehow involved in some sort of cover-up, but yeah, I don't think he's listed as a suspect or an accomplice.
No. So while this is happening, while Dotson's taken into custody, the search for Dennehy continues because there is no body at this point in time until July 25th, 4 days later, when they discovered a badly decomposed body in a gravel pit near Waco and was taken to Dallas for an autopsy.
Yeah, very gruesome, because it gets even more grotesque when we find out about what happened to the body, which brings us additional speculation because during the talking about... Well, go ahead, Jason. Tell us what happened with the body.
Well, so the following day, the medical examiners identified the body as Dennehy's. And on July 30th, his death was ruled a homicide after a preliminary autopsy report showed that Dennehy died of gunshot wounds to the head. And upon discovery of Dennehy's remains, the head and body were discovered in separate locations, Sal.
Yes, yes. Okay, so you and I have read and seen many documentaries and crime stories, true crime.
Yeah.
The head does not get separated. They're trying to say that scavenging animals separated Dennehy's head from his body And okay, fine, if you want to believe that, because the other idea would be that Dotson attempted to remove Dennehy's head from his body, which makes it even more horrific.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's illogical thinking, Sal. First of all, and this is really unfortunate, and it's sad that this even happened. And to get into speculation, sometimes I feel a little bit like I'm crossing the lines here, but you have a man who is 6'10".
Yeah.
And, you know, so he's already not just going to be your average person who they can't really identify based on his whereabouts. And maybe the idea was to sever the head because people know that they can identify people through their dental records or whatever reason. It's a lot of illogical thoughts going around. Maybe they were successful, maybe not, but something happened. I agree with you. I doubt that it was animals that did this, because this is not a frequent thing that happens with bodies found in shallow graves or what have you. What's shocking to me, Sal, is we just don't even get these answers out of Dotson when he is convicted.
Well, we get some information about him possibly suffering from hallucinations and hearing voices.
Right.
So then you think, well, a person like that might be able to do something as gruesome. You know, it's one thing to shoot somebody, right? It's one thing. That's horrible enough. Yeah. But then to attempt to decapitate someone, that's extra horrific. But then if you think the person who potentially did that was possibly psychotic, had incredible mental problems, hallucinations, hearing voices, then you think, well, maybe that person can do such a thing. So the whole idea was that Dotson might have been completely out of his mind to do something like this, to do more than just kill your friend, but to then dismember his corpse.
Yeah. And then on August 7th, a memorial service was held for Dennehy in San Jose, California. Now, in 2017, Sal, there was a Showtime documentary called Disgraced, which really did a deep dive into this. And I only recently learned of this documentary and planned to see it. I saw snippets, I saw the trailer, I saw some different scenes and thought, oh, wow, I need to see this. I'm interested. I don't know if there's any big revelations other than a lot more about the basketball program, which we're going to get into as we move forward. But it really makes me want to see it just to see what else is out there.
Yeah, definitely have to see it, especially after doing this podcast. Absolutely.
And so now we're getting into the court case. And subsequent to his August 2003 indictment, on October 28th, 2004, Dotson was declared incompetent to stand trial by District Judge George Allen and was sent to a state mental hospital to be reevaluated in 4 months' time.
You got to plead insanity. I mean, if any of us are ever accused of murder and we did it, you got to plead insanity. That's what you got to do.
So leave your pet more food than they need when you leave, and you got to plead insanity. Sal's takeaways.
You know, it seems like our court systems give quote-unquote insane people, a little bit of a pass. I say a little bit of a pass. I'm thinking there's this case from Canada happened a few years ago where one guy decapitated another on the Greyhound bus, began to then eat at his flesh. It's such a horrific story.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so that killer is walking the streets today, and they say as long as he takes his medication, he'll be okay. So that guy was quote unquote insane, killed somebody, and is walking the streets today. Speaking of, I believe Dotson is up for a possible parole as we speak.
Yes, or later this year. Back to the case. Three psychiatrists, including one appointed by the court, said that Dotson appeared to be suffering from hallucinations and psychosis, but that he could regain competency to stand trial in the future. Among other issues, Dotson believed people were trying to kill him because he was Jesus.
I used to know a guy at the gym, and this is absolutely true. When I used to work at a gym in Studio City, there was a big muscular guy, almost Herculean in physicality, would go around telling everybody he was Jesus. And at first I thought he was joking. I thought he's being silly. This guy was serious. He walked around the gym telling everybody that he was Jesus Christ. And after a while, I'm like, okay, this guy is not all there, you know? So, but the good news is if you do commit a crime, you start talking that sort of thing, people start thinking that you're crazy. But guess what? You can't really prove that. You can't prove that you're insane. You can't prove that you're having hallucinations. You can only try to make doctors believe that you're telling the truth.
Well, in this case, even Dotson's ex-wife noticed that he was hearing voices. Take that for what it's worth.
Yeah.
In February 2005, Dotson was returned to jail after psychologists deemed him competent to stand trial, but that he must continue taking his antipsychotic medication. The psychologist also said that Dotson's accounts of hallucinations and hearing voices were suspect.
again, you see, because you can't prove any of that. If you are missing a leg, you can go, look, you're missing a leg. You can prove it. As far as like I'm hearing voices, well, it's just your word, I guess, you know?
So Dotson's plan worked for a little while, Sal, but now he's back facing the charges as a sane person. And on June 8th, 2005, 5 days before his trial for murder was to begin, Dotson, with two court-appointed attorneys, both Baylor grads, mind you, whoa, as was the judge.
What?
Unexpectedly pleaded guilty to killing Patrick Dennehy.
I wonder what caused that. Like, how do you just do a 180 like that?
You go from insanity to now you're going to face these charges and this trial. And then 5 days before, you just say you murdered him. This makes no sense. Now, is it a coincidence that all these Baylor grads are at play here? And I think this is part of the storyline of the documentary, again, which we're going to watch after this, but very interesting. And then on June 15th, 2005, just a week or so later, Dotson was sentenced to 35 years in prison.
I almost feel like the legal counsel and the judge, all being Baylor alumni, I feel like that would be a conflict of interest, wouldn't it be?
I would think so too. And they wanted their guy. They wanted this thing to go away. Again, I'm just speculating here. But yeah, let's wrap this up. Baylor's got to move on. This is a black eye on the program. And that's that. Like, if you're going to stand trial, maybe they talked him into not going through the trial and he stood a better chance to live. Maybe it was going to be the death penalty. And if you admit to it, you can at least live out your days and you'll be up for parole at some point in time. But yeah, this is a huge change. And again, these facts I just learned through what little bit I saw of the documentary.
And here we are. He's eligible for parole in December of 2021. And I'm telling you, if for you and I and all of our listeners, if you watch and read enough true crime, you will know that right now, as you're listening to this, there are people who committed horrific crimes who are out there walking the streets on parole.
Yeah. Well, he was actually denied parole in December 2020.
Yeah.
But he's back up again later this year. Just to go back for 1 second, in December of 2005, Dotson wrote a letter seeking permission to appeal his case. But in January of the following year, a judge ruled that Dotson had forfeited his right to appeal when he pleaded guilty.
Yeah. Okay. So no appeal when there's a guilty plea. Yeah. Makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
Dotson is currently an inmate of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice and incarcerated in the John B. Conley unit near Kennedy, Texas.
Okay. So, Jason, we're going to start getting into the university reactions soon. But as far as motive, you know, when it comes to murder, there's always motive. Why? What is this? Just a case of jealousy? He was just jealous of his roommate. His roommate was redshirting, yet he was jealous of him. Dennehy had more hope, maybe. Maybe he was a better ball player. Why did he kill him? What was the motive for this murder?
That's a great question. As soon as I brought this case up to you, you had read about it and thought, what is the motive? Yeah, this has been your main quest in this case, and I'm with you. I don't know. How good of friends were they? Were they really scared of something, or did they just bond over guns? Some people just have activities they do together.
Sure.
And was it just that's how they bonded and then some sort of fight escalated? It could have been something so small and silly. I don't know if I buy all this fear factor going on. And then two other teammates. So I don't think there was motive other than argument gone wrong, hot-headedness.
Well, hang on, Jason. So you also have that they were fearing for their safety thing. What the hell was all that?
I don't know if I buy all of that, Sal. I think they just bonding over guns and an argument just went south. I mean, it can happen. Yeah, you were kept saying it wasn't premeditated because if it was, Dotson would have done a much better job of setting it up and then maybe make it look like an accident as opposed to gunshots to the head. Right? Like, oh, I shot him in the leg and he bled out and he would have done something smarter. So I just think it was two guys, maybe they're drinking, maybe they have an argument over something and it just goes south. And Daniel Copney, was he around? Was he shooting guns with them at this place? So I want to question him more, but we don't know the motive and I'm shocked that's never come out.
I mean, look at former Vice President Dick Cheney. He accidentally shot, and by the way, I'm holding up air quotes here. Cheney accidentally shot his friend while they're hunting.
Yeah.
So you could always say accidental, right? But running, you don't flee and take off in their car and take off the license plate. Yeah, it just becomes a whole big mess. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to just write this off. I think it was some sort of a jealousy. I don't think it was necessarily a fight. I think that he did shoot him. I don't think it was premeditated, but I do think in the moment, some sort of anger or resentment came out. He did shoot his friend twice in the head and then take off and try to cover it up. Now, the whole decapitation, we can speculate that all day, so let's forget about that for a second. But I think it was a crime of passion and then an attempt to flee, become a fugitive, and cover up. That's what I think this was. But unfortunately, I think it could have boiled down to possibly a lot of jealousy.
Okay. I'm not going to dispute that. I also believe it was a crime of passion, but I think sometimes an argument can go too far. And yeah, maybe it escalated. Maybe it came from the basketball court over, and maybe there was some of that stuff you're talking about at play. But I don't believe when they went out to go shoot that day that this was Dotson's plan. I think we both agree on that.
Yeah, probably not. I would probably say not.
So the day Dennehy's body was identified, the current standing president at the time of Baylor University, Robert B. Sloan Jr., made a speech to the public where he described the discovery as having the community's worst fears being realized, and that it was a heart-wrenching loss. And then he, along with many other representatives from Baylor, attended Dennehy's funeral. So Baylor University also held a campus-wide memorial for Dennehy on August 28th, 2003. Now, Sal, this definitely deals with university reactions and everything that be. But the other side of this, Sal, was all of the allegations that the NCAA brought forward against Baylor University. And this all happened after Dennehy's disappearance and death. But the men's basketball coach, the coach who recruited Dennehy and Dotson and put this team together, these charges were coming towards him because of a cover-up.
Well, it has to do with Dennehy's tuition or his actual right to be in the school and how's he paying for the school and you're not allowed to pay for students. Can you fill us in a little bit about that? What NCAA rules are college players are to be official amateurs unpaid, yes?
That is correct. Now, they might get full rides, scholarship, meals, whatever, but not to be paid. Now, I went to a big college program. I mean, I didn't play for them, but I was there at Oklahoma State when we made a run to the Final Four in 1994, got all the way to the Final Four, lost to UCLA in a very close game, who went on to win the title that year. So that program was pretty renowned. They had Big Country Bryant Reeves, top five in the NBA draft. They had Randy Rutherford, a great shooter, and they had a great coach in Eddie Sutton. He had had an amazing run, rest in peace, Eddie Sutton, at many programs, taking several of them to the tournament and having great success. Never won a title, but had great teams. So we had a great run for X amount of years there. Now, Sal, I don't want to throw my old school under the bus, but we saw things with the student athletes up close and personal, knowing some of them, going to parties. They're not allowed to have a job, at least not back then, but yet they're driving around in brand new cars. Not all of them come from money. A lot of them don't. A lot of the boosters and donors gift these things.
Sure.
I saw it firsthand, and there's a movie called Blue Chips, which is really great. William Friedkin, love his work, To Live and Die in L.A., which you can hear on the Let's Talk Movies podcast as we break that movie down. But Exorcist, French Connection, so many more. But Blue Chips, he tells that whole story. He shows a basketball program with Shaq and all these other players. And JT Walsh plays a donor who's amazing in that movie. Rest in peace, JT Walsh. But he's like paying the players. And yeah, it happens, Sal. We've seen it. I'm pretty sure it happened here.
Yeah. Bliss paid the tuition for Dennehy and another player. And also they didn't report players failed drug tests. But like, that's to me, this pales in comparison to the murder. But what happened is this opened up the Pandora's box and revealed all these scandals.
It's right. It did reveal it. And I'm not exactly sure what happened. I would just venture to say that Dennehy and Dotson and probably others, Sal, were being paid. How they were being paid, I don't know. I don't know if they're saying Bliss paid $40,000 of tuition for Dennehy and another player. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I thought tuition was covered because that's part of the perk of being a student athlete if you're on scholarship.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what was going on, but I do know that Bliss was part of a cover-up. And the fact that he had given Dennehy money, and once Dennehy passed away, Bliss was continuing this cover-up long after Dennehy had been murdered and buried. And he was saying, hey, the only person who knows that I gave him money is dead. There's audio recordings of Bliss talking this way to other people, which is insane, Sal.
To me, what really brings Coach Bliss, drags him down, he drags his own character down, really, is he asked players and an assistant coach to lie to investigators by saying Dennehy paid his tuition by dealing drugs. So
right.
Now he's defaming the deceased. Bliss, this is where you lost me right here.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. And you're absolutely right. It's despicable. It's unforgivable. Yeah. What if this didn't come out? And this is the new narrative. And Dennehy's family is like, he was a drug dealer? It's unconscionable. You cannot forgive this. And yeah, so I guess maybe he wasn't on full ride. Maybe Dennehy wasn't. So Bliss took it upon himself to make these payments and yeah, tried to cover it up. I'm not trying to justify Bliss's movements or his tactics, but he lost two players, Dennehy and Dotson. The program is reeling, so he's acting incredibly desperate. And thank goodness one of these assistant coaches got this on cassette tape, because this is back in a different era. It's like probably those micro cassette recorders that we used to carry around to school.
Yeah.
And so he got him on there. And of course, when this came out, Sal, this led to Bliss being banned from any coaching from the NCAA for at least 10 years.
You know what? I would say if he hid the failed drug tests, if he paid for Dennehy's tuition, I'll say fine, give him the 10-year ban, fine. But once you say, hey, everybody, let's say that Dennehy was selling drugs and that's how he paid his tuition, at that point, sorry, Bliss, you are banned forever.
Yeah, I don't know why it wasn't forever either.
Yeah, I mean, what's with this 10-year stuff? The guy tried to disgrace someone who was murdered. Absolutely horrible person.
And Baylor didn't even fire Bliss. He resigned due to the scandal. Yeah, he should have paid a bigger price for this. So it was despicable. It was a black eye. And listen, it took the program to nothing. You can imagine who wants to go there now, right? I don't even know if all the players even stayed
there. No. I understand some players transferred. They allowed them immediate transfer if they wanted to, yeah.
Let alone what the program is looked upon now as, but just emotionally. You know, Dennehy was a great friend. Dotson as well. This happened. You just want to move on in life and distance yourself from this whole tragic incident. So on August 22nd, 2003, 32-year-old Scott Homer Drew took the head coaching position of the men's basketball team at Baylor University. Now, Sal, this is not a job that most people would go near.
No, I mean, you're basically stepping into a train wreck, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, recruiting's impossible. You probably have minimal, if any, scholarships to offer players to come there. But Scott Drew took it over, and it was also a very late coaching change because practice was only 2 months away. So the first game was only a few months out. And of course, his top players, as we just talked about, had transferred. The program's in shambles, Sal, but I remember seeing videos now, like just recently, because of what just happened, of him then in 2003 saying, you know, he's going to come there, get things right, right the ship, do good by Baylor, and we're going to compete for championships. Yeah. People probably thought he was insane.
And you know what? Hell, you got to hand it to the guy. Somebody who would do that, somebody who would step into those shoes, got to hand it to him. Props and shout out for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So despite all this, the program was also put on probation until 2010. And paid scholarships and recruiting visits were significantly reduced, as I just mentioned. And postseason play was also canceled for the 2003-2004 season, which means even if you did qualify, but this team was not going to, based on everything that was happening, you couldn't even go on and play. So with all of these handicaps, Scott Drew led the Bears to an 8-21 record in 2003-2004. I would say, Sal, That's 8 wins more than they probably should have had. They won one more the following year. So the program's kind of floundering, but rightfully so. So then this past season, 2020-2021, the Baylor basketball team went 28-2 and were ranked number 2 in the nation behind Gonzaga. Well, the two teams met in the March Madness NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Championship game, where the Bears won 86-70, beating an undefeated Gonzaga Bulldogs.
So Baylor went into it 28-2, and that means, much like a fighter's record, 28 yep. wins, 2 losses, right?
Correct.
Is that a record? That sounds like that would be a record.
Well, Gonzaga was undefeated.
Holy cow. Wow.
So they were going to try to be the first undefeated team in many decades to just win it all. But they were not just beaten, they were manhandled in that game.
Yeah.
86-70. I watched it. Baylor's defense was suffocating. Their offense was unbelievable. He has built a powerhouse program.
Wow.
Yes, it took 17, 18 years.
Wow.
But he came through on his promise to the program. And not to mention, even last year, before the pandemic actually stopped the NCAA March Madness from happening, they canceled it last year, Sal, because that's right when things happen in March. Mm-hmm. So it was just canceled.
Yeah.
Well, the Baylor Bears were soaring high. I think they only had 4 losses last year. So he has this team on this trajectory for all these years. So who knows what they would have been last year, but this year, the fruits of his labor paid off. He's got a team, and not just a team. He's probably paved the way for the program to shine for years to come. So again, I don't want to overshadow the loss and the tragedy of what happened to Patrick Dennehy, but it's a nice story to see that the program can rise from the ashes, and the right man was there to lead them through this, unlike Dave Bliss, which was the wrong man that led. Yeah. Not only was there a cover-up, but what kind of coaching and tutelage are you doing when you're having that type of thing go wrong on your watch?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that whole our own teammates are threatening us. I mean, yeah, what the hell's going on in what should be a family? And then it's right under Dave Bliss. So, you know, this story has a villain, it has a victim, and it has a hero, I think, in the name of Scott Homer Drew. I mean, to bring Baylor to where it is today, a very interesting success story. But it brings to mind, though, right around this time when the murder happened, how it affected the morale of other sports, other Baylor sports. I mean, you know, what did this do to the baseball team, the football team? How did it affect their morale?
You know, I don't know. I do know that, unfortunately, this isn't the only black eye on the Baylor Bears programs. The football team had its own scandal many years later, 2016. Art Briles, his highly coveted football team, which were getting better and better with every year, were at the cusp of getting into the national championship games. They hadn't, but they were just getting better and they were knocking on that door. It's a hard door to knock down, I should say. Only so many teams tend to be in those games. But he had his team there and a huge scandal came out, a very different scandal. So it was a big cover-up with lots of players involved with sexual or violence towards women. It's not as if Briles was the ringleader, but he knew and there was a cover-up.
Man, these cover-ups. Something horrible happens, and then people cover it up. I keep thinking of Penn State.
Yeah.
Sandusky, right?
Yeah, Joe Sandusky. And then Joe Paterno knew about it, actually reported it, nothing happened, and life goes on. Well, then, of course, this all comes to light, and he's ousted, and then he didn't even live that much longer, Sal. So yeah, cover-ups are often just as bad as the actual crime.
I mean, you look at the Catholic Church, though, all the cover-ups with the molestation and the priests. And the way that our culture works is if something horrible happens and then everybody just comes out and says, hey, this happened, let's deal with it. Let's all work together to, you know, have justice or to resolve it. That's one thing. And I think that humans and people can be very forgiving. But the cover-ups, man, these cover-ups are what just make something horrible more horrible.
Yeah. By the way, have you seen the movie Spotlight? Best Picture?
No.
See the movie. It gets into the Catholic Church and how they broke the case. Wonderful film. But yeah, it's terrible. And it happened in this case as well. Of course, the real crime is the fact that we lost Brian Dennehy far too young. But his legacy lives on, let's hope. And that's why I think, Sal, that I was hoping for some sort of mention, not to be a downer on where Baylor's at now, but also just to make sure it never happens again. Not just at Baylor. I mean, anywhere something like this. And sometimes you can raise awareness just by kind of revisiting it, which is why I thought this podcast was important. You know, we're just beginning. It's our second episode. This show is That's a Crime. We cover all things from a misdemeanor to a murder. And we were going to ease our way in because the first episode was about this amazing heist and it's a little bit more lighthearted. And this comes right out with a murder, but it was a sense of timing. I felt it was important to cover now.
Yeah. No, I think it's good to have a tribute to Dennehy at a pivotal moment where you celebrate your victory. But then also, see, Dennehy is a part of the Baylor basketball legacy.
Exactly.
So I think to invoke his image and to invoke his name is incredibly apropos, suitable, and respectful.
Absolutely. Well said. And let's hope that if Carlton Dodson, who's definitely aged and had time to reflect and he's in prison, and if he ever gets parole or doesn't, maybe there'll be more. Maybe he'll share more as he has grown, let's hope. You know, maybe we'll get the full story at some point in time. I'm not holding my breath, but you never know.
Have they done any interviews in the last few years?
I don't know, but I know you and I are going to be watching the Showtime documentary.
Oh, yeah, so definitely.
We'll see what else we find out.
Yeah.
But yeah, this has been very enjoyable to explore this today. And I know Sal and I got our start together on Let's Talk Cobra Kai, which is a really fun show that covers Cobra Kai and Karate Kid. But you co-host sometimes on Let's Talk Movies, which we do deep dives into films. But I have other interests, as do you. And we have another shared interest in crime and all things crime. So I'm really excited about this show and the format. And we'll continue to investigate or talk about various crimes.
Yeah, because, you know, one of my things about crime, my interests personally are, A, how a crime is solved. And that's why Forensic Files is my personal favorite. I want to know how they solve that crime down to the hair fibers, right?
Right.
But also, it brings me great joy when a guilty person is put away. If you're an evil person, if you're a predator and you're put away, that makes me happy. So I hope that every time we have a story like this, someone is murdered in cold blood, especially a murder. I do hope that the perpetrator is put away.
And the only thing I like better than that is an innocent person getting out of jail.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. But they want to, you know, cheat them on how much money they give them, right?
Right.
They don't want to pay up. Yeah, yeah. If an innocent person gets out of prison, pay up, give them money.
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening. And please be sure to subscribe to That's a Crime wherever you get your podcast. You can also really help us by giving the show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts.
And for all you listeners that enjoy sharing your thoughts, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, send us a direct message, or post a comment on our social media, which is at Just Curious Media.
We also highly recommend checking out our other podcast and visiting justcuriousmedia.com.